Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Thank you for joining us tonight. We don't cover an abundant amount of paranormal topics, but when we do, they're usually captivating discussions. Joel Stern is with us tonight, and he'll be discussing his work on being a participant in bringing the Polish telekinesis case to the world's attention. Joel met the subject, Jawasa Gajewska, and she demonstrated her powers for him. Joel's book that he translated is entitled The Elusive Force. It's a really well done case study. Joel had a lengthy career in the State Department in the Office of Language Services. That sounds like it could be a show in itself. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. And I'd like to thank you for you and Barbara for inviting me to this discussion. I look forward to it, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that you or the listeners may have.
Yeah, I have like 4 pages of notes, so I think we have plenty of questions.
Wonderful.
Yes, and but before we start getting into looking at this case study, we need to stop for a moment and thank the paranormal investigator and Prince of Paleo Fiction, Max Hawthorne, for connecting us, and thanks for the Kronos Rising team at Facebook for tuning in for tonight's shows, and give them a shout out for all their support. So as we get started, this is just kind of interesting that you're a government agent. You work at the, or you worked at the State Department. I looked at their website. Yeah, it's some pretty interesting stuff. You get to work at, with the White House, and you get all the archives. So, tell us a little bit about what you did working at the State Department.
Well, before I worked at the State Department, I should tell you a little about my life before I started you know, working there formally. I majored in Slavic languages, first in Russian at the University of Michigan, and I also studied a number of other Slavic languages and received a master's degree there. That was back in the 1970s. And after that, I was kind of underemployed for a while. It's not easy to find a full-time job as a translator or an interpreter. And to make a remunerative living out of it. So for a while, I worked in various positions where I really wasn't able to use my language skills. I was a medical proofreader in Philadelphia at the Saunders Publishing Company, which published the Saunders, was the Dorland's Medical Dictionary, which at one time was kind of like the Bible for physicians. And I did freelance translation for Berlitz and a number of other private companies, as well as a few government agencies. Finally, in 1984, by chance, or maybe not by chance, however you want to believe it, I found a description of the Office of Language Services at the State Department, and among the many hundreds of resumes I sent out, I fired off one of my resumes to them. It turned out that my predecessor, he was in his 80s, named Emil Fossen, he knew something like 30 languages, maybe more, you know, 35, some, you know, an ungodly number. He was the government's premier linguist, and he happened to be retiring at the time that the office there received my application, and they invited me to take a number of language tests, and I passed them in Czech, Polish, Hungarian, and Russian. I think that was the record. I don't think anyone else has ever passed 4 language tests in one day. But I was inspired at the time. Plus, I needed the job. Okay, so I was motivated to do my best. And it took me another year to pass through the clearance process. And I began work at the State Department, the Office of Language Services, in March 1985, 39 years ago. That's what started the ball rolling. To describe the Office of Language Services briefly, the office worked for basically every agency of the U.S. government that needed language assistance. That could include the Social Security Agency, the State Department, of course, the White House, the Pentagon, you name it, all the manifold agencies of the U.S. government. And it's a well-kept secret, but nobody has ever even heard of the Office of Language Services. But without the talented linguists who work there, the government would not be able to conduct any foreign policy at all. You know, treaties have to be signed. Visiting dignitaries have to be, escorted by interpreters. Even if they know English, they prefer speaking in their native language, you know, for reasons of prestige and national dignity, which is only natural. The staff itself, the office is rather small. We handle the major languages such as Russian, French, Spanish, German, Italian, Portuguese, Arabic. But for the less commonly known languages, say Burmese, Armenian, you know, Georgian, what have you, we had a very large stable of contractors, freelancers, basically. I happen to be a staff translator responsible for Slavic languages, although I sometimes did German, Hungarian, and Romanian, but I concentrated mostly in Russian, Polish, and Ukrainian in the course of my career. And I personally found the work rather dreary, translating from one bureaucratic, well, I'll just say bureaucratic prose into English bureaucratic prose. The real only thing that really caught my interest was the presidential mail. Now, I'll briefly describe that. As you can imagine, people in the United States, in fact, all over the world, would write letters to the president of the United States,
right, okay,
or the Secretary of State, the First Lady, other high-ranking government officials. These letters would first go to the White House, where they have a, you know, correspondence unit. And the correspondence unit could handle the English, you know, language letters without any difficulty, of course. But for languages where they had no staff proficient in their given language, they would send the material over to the State Department for processing. And it so happened that I was responsible for scanning all the mail from Eastern, Central Europe, and Russia. And I estimate that in the course of my career, I probably read over 30 to 40,000 letters. And that is a paranormal subject in itself. It's worth a separate program. But so if anyone, you know, if people are interested in my background, that's essentially it. I retired in 2013. And that's basically my story, as a, you know, as a translator.
Okay, so are the Slavic languages very similar to Polish?
Well, they're not similar. Polish is a Slavic language.
Okay, I don't know a whole lot. I'll send the archive to our buddy Alexander, the Deja Vu author, and you know, he's going to be laughing at me about, you know, like my only like Polish word I know is like kibasi and
kielbasa, yeah, sausage,
yeah,
right,
yeah, you know, Polska, and it's very limited. He embarrasses me about how proficient he is in the English language, but we'll say that. But I really don't know a whole lot about the Polish language. I didn't know if there was, you know, they were very similar.
Well, it's a West Slavic language related to Czech and Slovak. There's the East Slavic branch of Russian, Ukrainian, and Belarusian. And they're the South Slavic languages, Serbo-Croatian, Bulgarian, Slovenian, Macedonian. And there are a few minor languages that I won't go into. So, you know, it's an extensive language family.
That's interesting. I'm learning.
And people may wonder, why did I pick that particular field? Well, my family came from Eastern Europe. My father's side from Austria-Hungary, the Hungarian part, which after the Second World War was annexed by the Soviet Union and is now in Western Ukraine. And the maternal side of my family was from Kiev. Partially my interest was sparked by my family history and also by my interest in Russian literature. I discovered Dostoevsky's books when I was, you know, in high school. And
Crime and Punishment's a good one.
Yes. Brothers Karamazov, of course. And, fortunately, my high school in Philadelphia offered a course in Russian, so I started taking the language early on, and I continued at the University of Michigan. Let's stop. Do you want to ask any questions about?
Okay.
You know,
okay. So. Okay. So let's look at. You have a fantastic foreign language background.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the original authors of The Elusive Force, and then how you got involved with them, and then we'll get a little bit more into the book, but
right.
You can just kind of cover those kind of aspects and, the work with translations and
right.
How that went.
Well, that again, that's almost a paranormal story in itself. When I was working in the State Department, I met a Polish couple. The husband was a bioenergy therapist. I mean, he worked with the human energy fields as a healer. And the wife was a journalist. And I met them in Virginia through a mutual acquaintance. And since I knew Polish, I could communicate with them. And we began to socialize. The wife, Margaret was her name, gave me the book in Polish to read, Niechwyt na Siła, which in English translates as The Elusive Force. And she praised the book and said that she knew an American publisher who might be interested in commissioning me as a translator for it. This was back in the fall of 1988. I read the book and was fascinated by the subject. I thought the story of this girl with psychokinetic and telepathic powers would be of interest to the wider public, not just the paranormal research community. So I set about translating the book. It took me, about 7 to 9 months altogether. See, I was still working at the State Department, full time, so
mm-hmm.
I couldn't devote myself completely to the translation. Unfortunately, the promise made by the Polish couple that there was an American publisher didn't pan out, but I'm not going to discuss that unpleasant aspect of the whole matter. Let's just say that I found myself with a translation and without a market for it. And I started sending it, the draft translation to my, to various publishers, such as Simon and Schuster. The response was always the same. Even when I did get a response, the subject was fascinating, the translation was excellent, but not enough publicity. Who would be interested in the United States in the case of a Polish girl with psychokinetic powers? She just wasn't well known enough in the English-speaking world. So that was a great disappointment. I did send my manuscript to Dr. Richard Broughton, who at that time was head of the Rhine Research Institute in Durham, North Carolina, one of the premier centers of paranormal research. He was kind enough to read the manuscript and make suggestions about, certain technical corrections. He even came to Washington to meet me, and he used the manuscript describe Jowasza Gajewski's case in his book, 1991 book, Parapsychology, the Controversial Science. One of the chapters is devoted to her case. A few years passed. I also sent the manuscript to a British paranormal researcher named Guy Lyon Playfair, who had written a book called The Enfield Poltergeist, about a famous case of poltergeist activity in the UK. He also read the manuscript, made a few valuable suggestions, to correct some technical terms. A number of years passed after that. In fact, maybe maybe 15 or 20. It's hard for me to keep track. It was such a long odyssey. In 2010, I sent the manuscript to White Crow Books, which publishes a catalog of paranormal, subjects in the UK. And John Beecher, the owner of White Crow Books, was interested in the subject, and he contacted the authors in Warsaw, Anna Ostitska and Marek Rumuszko, who unfortunately don't know English. So I had to serve as an intermediary in negotiations, and over a year's time, despite our best efforts, the deal fell through because of copyright issues. We just could not, reach a three-way agreement. I being in the United States, the authors in Warsaw, the publisher in England. It just proved to be an insurmountable barrier. And again, this is a great disappointment. So fast forward to 2022. I decided, after looking at my manuscript in the drawer, I wanted to give it one last shot. I don't give up easily, but this was going to be my one last shot. I sent an article I had written about the case to Anna Lisa Ventola, who is head of the Parapsychology Association in Columbus, Ohio. She was interested in the subject, but not being a publisher herself, she recommended Anomalous Books in Charlottesville, Virginia. So I sent another manuscript to Mr. Ouija, the owner of Anomalous Books, and lo and behold, he thought the book was publishable. So we got in touch with Anna Huszczycka. Unfortunately, Marek Rumuszko, her husband, had passed away in 2019. So we had to negotiate with her again, and I served as an intermediary. And after 9 or 10 months of, haggling back and forth, we agreed on a contract. And in the end of June, early July 2023, we finally signed the contract, 34 years after my initial translation. Isn't that quite a story?
Yeah, it is. But, you were basically done with the translation after the majority of the paranormal events, was kind of coming to an end.
Stopped around 1990. Yes, after I visited Yurasha and her family in Poland.
Okay, so it even though there's a gap, a lengthy time span from the conclusion of the events until publication, what readers are getting is pretty much a fresh recounting of the events.
Yes, the book concentrates on the events from 1983. The spring of 1983, when the occurrences first started, and through 1986. So basically a period of 3.5 years, and there are a couple addenda at the end of the book, updating case to 1989.
Okay, so let's take a look at as we structure, the events over, this lengthy haunting's not the right, unusual experience. What was going on How old was Yuasa?
Yeah, let me correct your pronunciation a bit. Yuasa. Now, her real name was Joanna, or Joanne, but nobody called her that. Yuasa is the diminutive form. It's like Joni for Joanne, mm-hmm. So it's Yuasa.
Okay.
That was her her nickname.
Okay. I'll work on the Yuasa. So let's look at the family structure, what's going on prior to all the weird stuff starting.
Her family structure, it's a very small family. Her father, Andrzej, was a plumber working in some kind of steel plant in Silesia, which is in southern Poland, a heavily industrialized area of Poland near the Czech border. Her mother, Eva, was a telephone operator, and Yuasa was an only child. The typical Polish family, nothing unusual about them, according to the book, anyway. Yuasa was 13 years old at the time these paranormal manifestations, if you want to call it, started happening during April of 1983, during the Easter holiday. Do you want me to describe what happened?
How old were the parents?
Know their exact 30? Ages. I would say, I had met them in 1989. They must have been in their 40s.
Oh, okay, 40, okay.
You know, not elderly. Certainly not at the time. You know, they were middle-aged.
Okay.
40, and late 40s, maybe 50 years old. It's hard for me to say.
Okay, so the start of these unusual events occurred around Easter. Do you think that had any kind of bearing on
No,
the religious
I really
cult?
Don't think so. There was no connection made between the these strange happenings and the Easter celebration. The only possible connection that the co-authors made was the death of Yuasa's grandmother in 1982, and this had a profound effect upon the girl. She was very close to her grandmother and took the loss very hard. This affected Yuasa's emotional state. Other than that, it's hard to conjecture what might have sparked these, psychokinetic events.
Okay, so let's look at, I think you did a great job of giving us, just some general background. Okay, let's move into when things started happening. Let's kind of delve into that for a little bit.
Well, it was an evening, I think it was April 4th, if I remember correctly. The family had been watching television in the evening and turned in for the night. Yuasa's mother went to her bedroom, and Yuasa and her grandmother were in the living room and on a some kind of sleeper sofa, and they were both sleeping. All of a sudden, late in the evening, some kind of straw mat fell off the wall, and the grandfather woke up and tried putting the mat back on the wall, and it started to dance around in the air, and he thought the girl was playing some kind of prank, but it turned out that she was sleeping. And then all hell broke loose. Objects of every type started flying around wildly, smashing into the walls of the efficiency apartment. The mother, you know, of course, was awakened by this terrible din and rushed into the room, and all three of the family members, you know, just stood petrified and frightened to death. They didn't know, couldn't understand what was happening, so they ran upstairs to the neighbors. The neighbors, of course, heard the, you know, tremendous racket on the first floor, and they thought that, you know, the Gajewskis were having some kind of drunken, you know, brawl.
Mm-hmm.
And they rushed down to see what was happening, and that's when they themselves, the neighbors, saw these objects smashing into. Actually, they didn't even see the objects because they were flying so fast. They could just see the shattered glass, you know, falling from the wall onto the, you know, the floor. And this kept up all evening. And the Gajewskis naturally were frightened to death, and they called the police. And the police thought some kind of hoax was being played. And they came over. At first, you know, they didn't observe anything, but they posted some kind of, I guess you would say, a policeman to watch the premises to see that nothing untoward happened. And eventually he did observe these, you know, psychokinetic effects, widespread destruction to the apartment, and he filed a report, and the town authorities came, and the conjecture was that something in the building's foundations might have been affecting the apartment, you know, the settlement of the walls, cracks under you know, water courses under the building.
You said that there was mining it was in the area too?
Yes. Oh, yes. Silesia. There was heavily industrialized area, factories, extensive mining. So that was, you know, at the time, that was considered a plausible hypothesis. But inspectors who came to check out the building didn't find anything wrong with the foundation, no cracks in the walls, and the structure was sound. And caution, the town authorities decided that the Gajewskis should change their, you know, dwelling, that a change in residence might resolve this problem in some way. And the Gajewskis did move to the town of Chelaj, which is sort of like a suburb of Sosnovets, you know, a few miles away from the bigger town. But this did not prove to be an effective, how should I say it, course of action, because these events continued to occur in their new apartment as well. This is when, go ahead, please, feel free to ask me questions.
Before, I think it's before they moved, after the city engineers,
right,
you know, came in, you know, the cops had been there to,
yes,
you know, protect the family if there was you know, drunken domestic violence stuff happening, but is that when there was a priest was called in to...
Oh yes, they did. I should have mentioned that. The Gajewskis are not an ostentatiously religious family. I mean, I didn't see any icons or on the wall or any kind of devotionalia lying on the tables anywhere. They were Catholics. They thought it might be a good idea to summon a priest to perform an exorcism just in case some kind of malevolent spirit was, you know, causing this destruction, but that failed to have any effect.
Okay. Then they move. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Joel. We just kind of backtrack to include the priest.
Right. I can only summarize so much. You know.
Okay. Before you know, I asked to backtrack. You had just started into the move to the nearby town. So,
right.
Did anything change? Did the change in habitation sites end the unusual event?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay. So we get more of this phenomenon is raging is might be a better word to use. It seems like it was very destructive.
Well, it was, and it's totally unpredictable. Even when the girl was asleep, this, I guess you would call it poltergeist activity, continued. She did not have conscious control over these events. And eventually, the case became so well known in Poland that a team of specialists was assembled to investigate the matter. And, you know, the book presents in chronological order the research conducted by several teams of specialists over the period of 40 months, the findings and hypotheses. And we can go into that further, but... go ahead, I'm sorry.
Now you just mentioned the starting to the case is starting to get media attention. Also realize like the medical establishment also realizes that this 13-year-old girl has, maybe some safety issues.
Well, let me correct you a bit.
Medical
establishment, that's wrong. Certain open-minded, courageous members of the medical establishment showed an interest. Remember, this was communist-era Poland back in the 1980s. Which had a distinctly materialist worldview. And academia, political establishment, the political authorities tried to their best to ignore this matter because it went against their, orthodox Marxist point of view. There were a few independently minded researchers and, who were brave enough to undertake research, even at the risk of their career and reputation. And I think that's still true in the majority of countries. Even in this country, paranormal research is not really held up as a, legitimate branch of science. This attitude hasn't changed a great deal. It's especially true 40 years ago in Eastern Europe.
And, word's gotten out about, teacups flying across the room and,
right.
But how you know, she has to be going to school, you know, at the age of 13.
Right.
How are her friendships changing, or things the same at, you know, the kids pretty accepting of her?
Not at first. She was called, not just the kids, but, you know, the other members of the community thought she might have been possessed. Remember, this was a conservative Catholic country. And such events, you know, aroused superstitious fear. A lot of the people in this community were, Southern Poland, were fearful, suspicious, anxious, and it created a great difficulty for Jerusha. Fortunately, she had a number of teachers who took the matter in hand and managed to persuade her fellow students that although these events were unusual, Jerusha herself had nothing demonic about her, you know, but she herself was a victim. And more or less, the other students began to accept her and were even thrilled when researchers began to study her case. You know, one of their fellow students attracted so much attention. So to answer your question, at first there was a lot of fear, but gradually she was accepted and, you know, tried to live her life as normally as possible.
Okay, you were talking about recreating this time period 40 years ago,
mm-hmm.
but there's also the communism would be coming to an end in a few years. You also have the Pope Paul II was from Poland,
mm-hmm.
as well. So I don't know if there's really a whole lot of that information needs to be included into the entire story, but for the listeners, I think we are trying to, present a general recreation of that time period.
Well, as I mentioned, there were two conservative establishments, the church and the Communist
mm-hmm.
Party. Different, but in some ways similar. They have a very circumscribed view of reality, and anything that goes beyond, transcends that reality is suspect, an object of fear, and that was the difficulty facing the researchers. They had to operate in that environment, and it was very difficult. Some of them did not want to reveal their identities because they feared, for their career. We can go into that later, because one of the reviews
sure.
of the book by John Kruth, the present head of the Ryan Institute, touched on that matter. Why weren't the results of these studies published in peer-reviewed journals? Well, there's a very good answer to that, which we can discuss later in the
sure.
In the show.
Sure. We can do that. Okay. We can keep moving on to other topics. What's going on with Jerusha? Am I getting closer to saying that right?
Yes.
Okay. It's just kind of localized at that point, but Japanese TV learns about it, and they start to make it a little bit more of drawing more attention to it. It becomes more of an international story.
Well, it wasn't just the Japanese. If you remember one of the chapters, I can't remember the title of it, but there were calls from all over the world.
Is there Danish TV or is that one?
I'm trying to remember.
I hate to scroll through the book.
There were so many contacts made with the family at that time, trying to capitalize, on this case for, selfish mercenary motives. The family was naturally apprehensive that she would be exploited, They
Right.
wanted to protect her from, manipulators. After all, she was just a teenage girl trying to go to school and live a normal life. And these events were making things very difficult for her and the family, too. This is when the authors, the book, Marek and Anna, first heard about it, when events, news began trickling out of, the local community into the Polish mass media. They wanted to investigate the case objectively, free of sensationalism. And they earned the girls' trust. They're honest, ethical people. And they wanted to separate fact from fiction, and they, in time, realized that this was not a hoax at all, but something serious was actually happening.
In
mid-1983, maybe May of 1983, when they became involved in the case.
Okay, it's on page 15. A Danish journalist got involved. There was a famed psychic
from Paris. Right.
All
these people were not trying to make a fast buck off this girl's misfortune.
Yeah, a Czech newspaper called...
Right.
We're starting to get all this... international media attention, that can be damaging for any young person, Yuasha is also experiencing headaches. She's having some of these physical responses to what's going on as well. Her medical team is it seems like they're actually very concerned about her health as these events keep going on.
Well, yes, naturally, because at times she was injured herself by these flying objects, cut by glass. She did suffer from frequent colds. And the medical team, headed by Dr. Gadula, who's a surgeon, he basically led the research in her case. He did everything he could to protect her well-being and shield her from, outside manipulators. So to answer your question, yes, she did suffer physically, and of course this constant tension, unpredictability, would naturally have an effect on her health. Of course.
Okay. Okay, she She has scientific tests show that she had a decrease in dopamine, but no thyroid problems. That, you know, they weren't sure if they were able to rule out epilepsy. So
I wouldn't say that. Since her brain wave pattern showed a certain features, characteristic of epilepsy, but without her actually having a full-blown case of it. That's one of the hypotheses in the book. You know, that's very detailed. And one of, you know, the two chapters in the book go into that in great detail about the hypotheses that her brain configuration contributed to the origin of these events.
Okay. Yeah, there were these thermal photos.
Yeah, thermal
of her
spots
body.
In her fingers and her toes. Yes.
In the extremity. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I may have to mention it now. But there were other children at the same time who. We're going through the same experience.
Well, the authors presented a list of cases in Poland that strangely occurred at the same time. Now, whether this was a coincidence or a way to piggyback on Yuasz's case to make money, you know, the authors don't make a comment on the validity of these other cases. They just present them. They did not investigate them personally. They were focused on Yuasz's particular experience. So in making, you know, a list of these other occurrences, they don't pass judgment on them.
Right,
it's strange that they were occurring at the same time, though.
Yeah, they were listed as other, like, tween boys and girls. So, yeah, both genders being mentioned in there. I'm just wondering if they had the same kind of tests, like the thermal tests or...
There's no mention of that in the book whatsoever. I think Yuasz's case is unique in that several teams tested her over a period of 40 months. I don't know of any other case of poltergeist activity where that's true. You know, and it was remarkable that this even happened because, as I mentioned, the scientific establishment and medical establishment was not receptive to this type of research.
Okay.
Very brave people stepped forward and, you know, and I can only commend them for their courage and their, you know, integrity.
Yeah, for that time, demand for, you know, like uniformity, and we don't talk about stuff like this at that time. I think that's a fair assessment about some of the doctors.
I certainly think it's true of the medical establishment in this country. That's a separate topic altogether, but I have my own views on it. You know, the biochemical paradigm in psychiatry, for example, is the prevailing, you know, view, and everything else is considered fringe. Were disreputable. were illegitimate, you know. And I think that was the prevailing attitude 40 years ago as well.
Okay. And you also had an appendix.
Yes, Dr. Gadula, the surgeon, removed her inflamed appendix. And he did it himself because he was afraid that some kind of psychokinetic event might happen during surgery. And he wanted to be there to prevent it if he possibly could. Fortunately, the operation went smoothly, and she was not injured at all.
Okay, but later the stitches came out?
Yes, yes, for some unknown reason. So he had to restitch her abdomen. Poor girl.
As we've been getting into this case, there was a reference to maybe some of this paranormal activity could be related to the loss of her grandmother, the year prior to it starting, she was hoping for a closer relationship with her dad. Is there any kind of symbolism to this kind of like her ability to if she's causing the mirror to break in the bathroom or stuff flying across the room, is there something symbolic of these behaviors if she's causing all the if it's telekinesis?
Well, that is one of the major hypotheses in the book. If you remember, there's a Dr. Miroslav Harchadik, psychologist, who investigated this case very thoroughly and gave her a couple dozen very sophisticated tests. And one of his hypotheses was that her emotional state in combination with her hormonal activity in the stage of puberty was responsible for the origin and continuation of this psychokinetic activity. And that was the basic conclusion of most of the researchers, actually. The question remains, however, lots of teenagers in a stage of puberty have emotional upsets. In fact, it's typical of teenage years. Why did it happen to her and not to all these others? What made her case so extreme and unusual? Not, it lasted for 7 years, whereas most poltergeist activities last maybe a few months or a year. That's what makes the case so extraordinary. There's no explanation. To say that hormones and her emotional state caused this, even if that were true, why not other teenagers? Why her? What was so special about her body, her brain? That's why the case is so fascinating to me.
The case study is so gripping as well. Appendix being removed and the other tests and low dopamine and stuff like that. Okay, they're covering a lot of things that from 40 years ago. How do you explain this? That's one of the interesting parts of the book.
Well,
what makes her so special?
I might bring in the subject of another review of the book done by Rob Tilley, for the Australian Journal of Parapsychology, who completely dismisses all the scientific research. He thought it was nonsense. He believed the case could be explained by a manifestation of a spirit, either a ghost or some discarnate entity. And he claimed, and Mr. Tilley claimed, that if a well-trained medium had been brought in, the case could have been resolved very quickly. There would have been no book, and implying that the authors and the researchers were either colluding in some sort of hoax or they were incompetent. But his explanation, his spiritualist explanation, doesn't account for the fact that other teenagers are going through emotional upheavals. Why was Yuasha visited by this discarnate entity or this ghost or her grandmother? Furthermore, Yuasha had these remarkable spoon-bending talents, which were demonstrated without, you know, fail in front of numerous researchers. She had telepathic abilities. Did this entity or ghost bend the spoons for her? Did they, you know, perform the telepathic test for her? That doesn't explain anything. Tilley claimed that she had accessed higher levels of consciousness, which opened up, he created an opening for this spirit to come through and manifest itself. Well, first of all, there was no evidence whatsoever in the book that she was interested in witchcraft or Ouija boards or anything that had anything to do with occult practices. This is a completely groundless claim, you know, concocted out of thin air. He was, you know, he had a spiritual agenda, and he admitted in his review that he could not understand any of the scientific theorizing in the book. Well, if he couldn't understand the scientist's research, why could he dismiss it so easily? You know, it's a dishonest review, in my opinion. I'm not saying that some spirit was not involved. Who knows? Maybe there could have been. But, you know, I don't think that hypothesis is more plausible than any other, illusion of anything else. There's a real split. You know, I found out in the course of my, you know, research and discussions with people, there's a real split in the paranormal research community. We have the spiritualist camp who ascribe everything to, you know, entities of various types, or you have the strictly scientific views that, you know, dismiss any kind of spiritualist explanation and try to concentrate on, you know, a wholly materialistic approach. Being an agnostic myself, I don't take any firm stance one way or another. I'm open to any explanation, but it has to be based on the facts, not on, you know, a priori hypothesis that, you know, forces the facts into some kind of rigid framework.
Joel, you were talking about, one theory might be, for an explanation of these events, maybe Yuasha tapped into this higher level of consciousness. Maybe there might be some kind of spiritual connotation with that. But, you know, if you look at, I was just trying to think of ways to link this to other topics. But, you know, you do have some of this spiritual aspects to you know, a movie like Carrie, you know, Stephen right. King is exploring mm-hmm. that in, you know, I think that was his debut novel. But at least in the end of the movie, you know, Carrie's mom goes into, you know, like a religious fervor meltdown mm-hmm. Type situation. It is such a scholar of unusual events like Stephen King tapping into one of these lesser understood aspects of the human condition that is also embodied in Yuasha.
Well, I don't know what I can't kind of... answer that question because, frankly, I'm not familiar with Stephen King, and this is a very complex phenomenon. I'm not sure there's a single cause for every such case. There may be a multiplicity of causes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Why, for instance, example, why did it suddenly latch on to this 13-year-old Polish girl and then suddenly disappear after 7 years? You know, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
To explain one inexplicable phenomenon with another phenomenon doesn't really get us very far, in my opinion.
Okay, yeah, I was just wondering, because, you know, we, you know, kind of routinely cover Twilight Zone type topics on this show as well. And, you know, we have, you know, some terrific Rod Serling scholars on here as well. And, you know, there's just, I think I was just kind of looking for a comparison that audience members might be able to, you know, relate to, since, you know, hopefully they'll read the book after, you know, be motivated to read the book after the show. But these kind of topics have been touched on, you know, like Carrie or Twilight Zone. You know, the X-Files had one on this. It was a little boy doing the spoon bending as well. And we haven't really gotten into that in very much detail yet. But, you know, these types of topics are frequently discussed in the media, and I, you know, I think probably the X-Files helped to make it more popular to discuss these topics as you were completing the translation, and you know, we're watching the X-Files throughout the 90s. But you know, so what was going on with the spoon bending? And she did, Yuasha did one for you as well when you met her.
Well, actually, two.
Oh, two,
well,
okay.
This is not long after I completed my translation in the summer of 1989. I got in touch with the co-authors, Mark and Anna, and, you know, told them that I'd finished my work and that I'd like to meet them. And since I could communicate with them in Polish, that made things a lot easier. I went to Warsaw in the fall of 1989 and met both of them. And they invited me to go along with them, excuse me, on a trip to Czeladź, town in southwestern Poland where Yuasha and her family lived. And so we drove down there from Warsaw, and I met the family. They lived in a very modest apartment in a Soviet style, you know, building, you know, concrete, very unattractive. The apartment was very battered, you know, by all the flying objects, you know.
Mm-hmm. And, I understand.
Iwasha apparently took a liking to me, and she offered to bend a spoon for me. And so she went to her bedroom and brought a steel spoon with her, and I watched her closely. She held the spoon in her hand and started rubbing it with one or two fingers. I can't remember exactly how it took place, but after a couple minutes, it started to droop, you know, like a wilting flower, and it became twisted like a pretzel. I couldn't believe my eyes. You know, I had my first and only paranormal event. You know,
Did the spoon get hot?
Well, I didn't touch it while she was doing it, but when she gave it to me, it wasn't warm. It just was twisted. And the second time when I visited her in the fall, summer of 1990, the authors took me there again, along with a physicist who had done some research on Iwasha, and she bent a spoon for me a second time in the same way, you know, a couple minutes of rubbing it with one or two fingers. And I still have both spoons as mementos of my soul paranormal experience. The strongest man in the world could not unbend those spoons. Unbelievable.
Oh, okay.
What they look like.
Fascinating.
And, she couldn't do this on command. She had to feel some kind of rapport with the researchers. Otherwise, she would freeze up. That's mentioned in the book.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a totally mechanical process. You know, she could be just commanded, do this, do that. No, it didn't work like that. She had to form some kind of emotional bond with the people around her to accomplish anything. And sometimes she failed, you know. If the researcher at hand was skeptical or, you know, closed-minded, then sometimes the experiment failed. But I saw numerous bent, twisted objects in the apartment, you know, these massive steel communication cables.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
And she also bent pipes in a bathroom.
Oh, right, when she went to a sanitarium for testing. Dr. Gould, I mentioned, was a surgeon who was head of a vocational rehabilitation center, and he brought her there for, you know, testing. And in the course of 20 seconds, she basically demolished everything in the room, you know. A sink was twisted out of it, you know, out of the wall. The faucets were bent. And, you know, I mean, she didn't do this with tools. I mean, just some kind of psychokinetic energy that nobody could explain. It happened within 20 seconds.
Okay, she windows.
Oh, yes, yes.
Suddenly
that's
have
described thoroughly
cracks.
In one chapter. You know, her stay at the sanitarium was the, I guess you would say, the high point of her psychokinetic destructiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, she was a teenage girl, and she wanted to show off. She was jealous of some of her rivals who claimed to have similar powers. So she became jealous of them, and she wanted to show what she could do.
Okay.
Sounds funny,
so,
doesn't it? But the people who witnessed these events were frightened and out of their wits.
Okay. So, you do get all this stuff documented by Dr.
Gabula,
and his
colleagues.
Harchotic.
Harchotic, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so some of the other, their interviews with the nurses.
Right.
Okay, that seems to be presenting reliable observations is part of the job requirements. Maybe some of the Japanese film may be able to prove the point, but what do you think about the reliability of what was said about what they witnessed right after the bathroom's pipes are all...
In another podcast I was asked that question, about the Amazing Randy. Why should I trust, the reports of these observers, these researchers, what makes them credible? Well, my answer is this. There are three possibilities. Either Yuasha was cleverly perpetrating a hoax over a period of 7 years and managed to fool everyone around her for this lengthy period of time, or all these researchers and eyewitnesses were colluding in a hoax for some selfish purpose, or the third possibility, these events were really happening and what these people described was in fact true and worthy of further study. I find it hard to believe that these teams of specialists would risk their reputation and careers by perpetrating a hoax that, if proved false, would cost them dearly. And if this teenage girl was able to perpetrate a hoax over a period of 7 years, how did she do it? Did she hypnotize people? I mean, if that were the case, then that itself is something worthy of study. I tend to believe the findings and conclusions of these researchers. I have no reason to doubt their integrity or their competence, unless proven otherwise. Which brings up the point that I mentioned before. If these observations and test findings were in fact above board and true, why weren't they published in peer-reviewed journals? That was one point brought up by John Kruth, the head of the Ryan Institute, in his review of the book, that the book is more for entertainment value rather than informative, that it indulges in extreme exaggeration. Well, my rejoinder to that comment is this. Kruth ignores the context 40 years ago in Poland. It would be very difficult to break through the barrier of misunderstanding and prejudice and ignorance that prevailed then and now in the scientific establishment, where things that go against the established paradigm are either ridiculed, suppressed, or ignored. I have no,
good
as
point.
I said before, I have no reason to doubt the integrity and competence of the authors of the book. I don't think they were indulging in cheap sensationalism. Otherwise, I wouldn't have undertaken the translation. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
No. Oh,
they,
thank you,
just one other point. The distinction that Kruth makes between information value and entertainment. Well, in my opinion, this is a false dichotomy. A good author, a good journalist, can do both. he can entertain the reader with solid, objective, verifiable information. Why does there have to be a dichotomy? I think the book succeeds. I think it captures the reader's interest, and it presents some very serious scientific findings and hypotheses that are worthy of consideration and should be dismissed out of hand. That's my own view.
Charles Dickens did that, and Poe. They wrote journalistic pieces, and many of their own fictitious stories mm-hmm. were based on covered as journalists.
Well, that's a very good point. So I'm saying entertainment doesn't necessarily have to be frivolous. It can be serious mm-hmm. and informative at the same time. And that's right. What I consider this book to be.
I liked it. I thought it was very interesting.
Thank you.
There are also photos of the family.
Yes. Unfortunately, the parents have passed away.
Okay. They seem like. I'm not sure exactly when the photos were taken, but maybe you could see how the photos reveal changes in the parents the whole family as the events were unfolding. Like there was one, the mom had dyed her hair, the dad had shaved off his mustache, then eventually his beard. So there were changes. I don't know enough about the parents to see if there's a direct correlation, the time, mom dyed her hair. Was that related to the...
I only met them twice. And I'm the translator. I did not have constant contact with them. So you raise a good point, but I really can't answer that question.
Yeah. No, I was just wondering. The photos do... show a change over time. Yuasha has in one photo just a trading stare.
Oh yes, those are my favorite photographs. Yes, she had very piercing eyes.
Yeah, that just doesn't look like a normal 13-14-year-old girl. It looks like she was very much aware of how this was impacting her, maybe her family as well.
Well, we'll never know, unfortunately, because all contact, all trace of her has been lost. She got married, graduated from nursing school, had two children, and for all I know, she may have emigrated abroad, to make a better living.
Yeah.
All these questions are fascinating, and it's a shame that I couldn't break through the wall of ignorance and apathy earlier on to bring this case to public attention back in the 1990s when we still had a chance. It's a very sad story. I tried my best, but I didn't have the influence, the authority, the recognition to breakthrough.
One of the last things we know about her is that she wanted to help people. And you said
yes. That's why she went into nursing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it just seems like there might be some kind of connection between her stare, the how that is related to her inner turmoil, and maybe if she felt that she had healed herself enough afterwards, that she'd be good working with patients at a hospital or her own practice.
Well, maybe her distressing experiences as a teenager developed a sense of empathy and compassion in her.
Right.
To want to help other people in, troubling situations. It's very possible. I can only speculate. When I met her and talked to her briefly, and I had a good feeling about her. She seemed like a very pleasant young lady at the time, but because all trace of her has disappeared, we just don't know. It's a great shame.
Okay. Some of the other parallel cases, there was one about Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Oh, I heard about that. Yes.
Was there? Do you see any kind of connection or similarity?
I'm not intimately familiar with his case, Mark. So
okay.
I can't comment meaningfully. Every case to me has unique features. Some last longer than others. Some are more intense than others. Some occur under different conditions. I really don't think there's a single explanation for the complexity of this phenomenon. That's my basic view. And if I could be proved wrong, I'm willing to admit it. But I don't see any one explanation out there that accounts for everything.
Okay.
I just don't know.
Yeah, no, that's, fair to, state. I don't know. Document is just really fascinating. Gets you thinking about spiritual aspect. Since we've had done two or three shows on profiling, I think people like Mark Olshaker have shown the audience, some of these patterns
mm-hmm.
That you can learn about serial killers, but can you also start seeing what seems to be unrelated cases? Or if you look closely enough, are there patterns there? And I think that's one of the interesting aspects of the case study that you helped to present.
Well, what was I going to say? The theory, it used to be common that these poltergeist activities would occur primarily among teenage girls in a undergoing puberty-related hormonal changes, and their emotional upheavals would interact with the hormonal changes to produce these violent kinetic effects, which seemed plausible, but a lot of teenagers, as I mentioned before, are undergoing the same, emotional upheavals in a state of puberty, but yet they don't cause these destructive effects. What happens with certain people to set them apart? That, to me, is the great mystery. I mean, is it some kind of spiritual manifestation, some entity? It's one hypothesis, but that's what makes the case so fascinating. It's still relevant, and as I mentioned to you earlier, that the interest goes beyond mere events described in this one book. It it's a matter of the nature of human consciousness in general. What are the limits? Are there limits? And what is the nature of reality itself? Are there higher or parallel realms where these entities or ghosts or whatever spirits exist, and for some inexplicable reason they decide to descend to the earthly plane and manifest themselves? But what, why with some people and not others? That's the unsolved mystery we're dealing with.
Yeah, well, I think it goes back, you get, something similar to, the like age-old question. It's like, where do you go when you after you die? Can you still talk to them? You get the Witch of the Endor example in his book of one of the books of Samuel, I think, but in I think the Witch of Endor, I think the king couldn't see the ghost, but witch could. But it shows that something about consciousness, perception. It's going back to what, 3,000 years ago. I think these are questions that have been asked for a long time.
From the dawn of human history.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned the question of perspective, because Western science, for all its achievements, hasn't been able to explain these phenomena, whereas in other cultures, perhaps, like shamanistic cultures, would be more receptive to this type of activity. In other words, they would have a broader understanding. It wouldn't seem so strange. People in ecstatic or trance states, such as yogis, the autobiography of a yogi, which it, sets forth events that are inexplicable to, you know, the Western mentality. I mean, phenomena like Yawasha's might have a better reception or a clearer understanding.
We don't have the tools
in our armamentarium, in our Western, you know, laboratories to determine the cause. We can measure the effects, perhaps, but as for finding the ultimate cause, we're not advanced enough. We don't have, the tools are insufficient.
Well, I think you're bringing up the shaman. I would probably see this as totally different than today's, Western scientists, and I think the shaman were looking more holistically at the earth, heavens, people. With today's science, there's a there's only observations and the guy floating around on the puffy white cloud, he doesn't count. There's a break between the science and religion, which I think probably a lot of people wouldn't understand that in today's context. But, like a shaman probably would realize that have a more comprehensive view of Yawasha's case.
Well, that's my own opinion.
I agree with it.
In another podcast, Ian Gilchrist, a British psychiatrist who's done extensive research on the functioning of the cerebral hemispheres, and basically, very simplistically put, his view is that the left hemisphere has become the dominant mode of perception in Western society over the past couple of centuries. It contributed to the rise of the scientific method, but yet it's narrowed our view of reality to a great extent. And, the right hemisphere, which is more holistic, intuitive, has been relegated a secondary role. And to some extent, that's been to our detriment. We have a very narrow, focused view of reality, a tunnel vision, I call it. And anything outside the tunnel either doesn't exist or is marginal, insignificant. And that's one difficulty the paranormal researcher encounters.
Information we discussed. There's the RSPK, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. Is that a little bit different from just to throw out the movie Carrie, is there a difference between Yawasha's case and
I'm not a professional in the field, but I can say this: she managed to control this uncanny energy to some extent. Not completely. Sometimes psychokinetic effects would occur when she was sleeping or otherwise, unfocused. But on other occasions, she was able to channel the energy. Why was she able to do it where others can't? I don't know if that answers your question. In her case, well, in my opinion, her case differed somewhat in that respect.
Okay.
From others that I'm aware of. I'm not making a universal, you know, judgment here, but it seems to me that her case has some unique aspects in its duration, in the intensity, in the fact that she was studied so thoroughly over 40 months by several teams who verified the existence of these phenomena. And this is what makes the book so interesting to me personally, and I think it should be relevant to others who are interested in, you know, problems of human consciousness.
Well, people are different, and being able to do the telekinesis while sleeping, that might be something different for, I know it's new information for me. I'm sure some of the listening audience may not be aware of it happening during a sleeping state.
Well, actually, I forgot to mention this, but Anna Ositska and Marika Mushko wrote a sequel to this book called The Return of the Elusive Force in 1994, a case in a Warsaw hospital where a person in a coma, he got someone who's completely unconscious.
Wow.
Was brought to a hospital, and this caused a series of violent psychokinetic effects, highly destructive manifestations over a period of several days, if not a week. I forget the exact amount of time. So this person had no consciousness whatsoever. I think he was in a drunken stupor, and he fell into a coma. And when he died, eventually, these effects immediately stopped. So there was a sequel to the book. 5 or 6 years later, and the authors actually observed these psychokinetic effects. This was not secondhand, you know, reporting. They actually saw these things happening. It was amazing. But, you know, I wanted to translate the book at one time, but, you know, I couldn't even find the publisher for the first book. You know, so why should I begin translating a second one without any hope of, you know, finding a publisher? If the elusive force attracts enough attention and, you know, sells and, I might be inspired to translate the second book because I think it's certainly worthwhile bringing to public attention, but... You know, it's a time-consuming process. Very, you know how difficult it is to translate a book like this? It took me almost a whole year.
No. Oh, it's
very exhausting.
Yeah, I ought to, try being a podcaster and getting a hold of some of these publishers. And, you know, Barbara gets all these emails back. The author died 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, he won't be a guest.
You know, just to bring up a different subject, slightly different, the publishing industry, I told you my travails in trying to find a suitable publisher. Just think of the amount of material in foreign languages that's out there that is worth, you know, study, you know, that could offer valuable insights into so many aspects of human conduct and the world in general. And it will never see the light of day because of publishing considerations, you know, selfish, mercenary motivation, you know, lack of interest. I succeeded after 34 years because I was insanely persistent. You know, but so many, it saddens me to think how much valuable literature could be out there in languages that will never be translated. You know, it's a sobering thought, you know?
Oh, and then you get all the, you know, burning of the Alexandria library.
Right, exactly,
you know, like,
exactly.
How much information do we need that has been lost, and you know people like Petrarch were trying to translate books, and he only got to only a few of the books in the Vatican Library, you know, which is buried in some of these libraries that we're never going to find out what wisdom that the ancients are able to depart on us.
Well, think of the tremendous amount of literature in Sanskrit, like the literature
right.
of the Vimanas, the flying craft.
Mm-hmm.
So much of that is still untranslated. So many alchemic texts in ancient Greek or Babylonian or Arabic.
Those are all good.
Remain untranslated. Think of the treasure trove of wisdom that all this material could give us, and we'll never see the light of day. You know, it's such a sad thought.
And while we were talking, I did find something of one of the passages that you translated, I thought it's relevant to this section. Julian
Ochorovitch.
Yeah,
Ochorovitch. Don't worry about the pronunciation. Ochorovitch.
Yeah, the Polish philosopher and psychologist once said that nothing is more conducive to progress than discoveries at variance with the prevailing theories. I thought that...
Yes, that's a profound thought,
I just,
and it's eternally true. Eternally
true. Yeah, like what you said about, just say the Sanskrit text. How much progress could we have if we knew what they were telling us about, they have... Mm-hmm. All kinds of, Pliny the Elder wrote a lot about issues and cures.
Well, I don't think we're wiser than the ancient Greeks or Sanskrit scholars.
Nope.
In some ways, perhaps we've degenerated.
Yeah.
Our scientific equipment may be more advanced, but actual process of thinking, cognition, perception of the world, I fail to see how we advance. I don't see any Platos or Aristotles or Leonardo da Vinci's wandering around the campus. You know,
we only just have Max as an example.
Oh, right, right. Well,
yeah,
yes.
It's just... Max caused me to lose my train of thought. Besides talking about the drab communist housing, public housing,
right.
Apartments. The same time, maybe a little earlier. You've really gotten into Art Deco.
Oh. Why do you mention that?
just have an interest in it. I was just wondering, how you got interested in that form of architecture. Our audience really enjoys all kinds of aspects of history. And
I think there's a paranormal aspect to that. You're familiar with the concept of time slips, people finding themselves in different eras, either past or present. I mean, a past or future. And they find themselves in a strange world where they're not fully at home, you know. I've always been attracted to the music and the architecture, the general artistic trends of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Mm-hmm. Ever since high school, when I started listening to the, you know, in Philadelphia, there's a WCAU program from 9 to 12 every night, and during the weekdays, there was a big band program. It's a Goodman, Dorsey, Miller, I think it was called. This guy would play this old big band music for 3 hours, and it hooked me. It was like coming home. You know what I mean? I wasn't listening to the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or, you know, the Hollywood Argyles or the Alley Oop. You know, I was listening to the big band music from that period, and I became so enthralled with it that I started taking an interest in other aspects of the culture of that period, and I started collecting old radios, believe it or not, and have about 30 of them. You know, the old tube radios? And from there, I branched off into furniture, lamps, clocks, appliances, and my whole house is furnished like a 1930s time capsule. So I don't have any rational explanation for this. It just feels natural to me.
Okay.
And one day, if I have the time and I can find a competent regression therapist, hypnotherapist, I'd like to go back and find out the source of this fascination.
Yeah,
does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Somewhat, because I don't have a fully rational explanation. Why Art Deco instead of mid-century modern, or instead of Victorian instead of early American, or Japanese furniture? You know, it's just this particular period that draws me.
Barbara and I have this idea. You know, it's a musical idea, and I kind of had one guest lined up, and you know, the show didn't happen at the last minute, and I think that some of these, you know, modern like hard rock guys actually go back to some of the big band music for ideas, and just say, you know, take the A Train or something like that. There are elements from, you know, those like what, 1940s, Let the Good Times Roll or something like that, that you can kind of see the energy, the spirit kind of put into, you know rebellion against the Prohibition era, and, you know, the speakeasies, and that translates really well into almost like today's heavy metal music.
Well, heavy metal makes my head ache, so I'll take your word for it.
Okay, well, Barbara kind of had the same, like, oh my gosh, you aren't getting into this on the show, and It's a great look at today and how where the influence comes from, and you can also just look at one of the things I did want to bring up, that's where Max calls me lose my train of thought, was you were talking about de-evolution. We don't have a Leonardo today. I still wonder about books like Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth, where he is kind of looking at nothing today is as big and vibrant as the Pleistocene period. So I that's like my 2 cents worth as we get closer to the end of the show. But I just wonder how why were things 10, 20,000 years ago so much different than today, so much bigger, and maybe not so much left-brained.
Well, Ian Gilchrist, whom I mentioned, that neuroscientist and psychiatrist, he could answer that much more eloquently and, thoroughly than I could possibly do. But we've created a different society, and current conditions in such a way as we lost other skills. The Australian Aborigines have skills that have atrophied in us. I mentioned that in another podcast, that these so-called primitives have tracking skills, orientation perspective that just eclipse anything that Western man could conceive of. And true of shamans, they have a perspective that, far transcends the narrow scientistic view of, of the Western medical or scientific establishment. We've achieved progress, but in some ways, but in other ways, we've, degenerated. Everything comes with a price, everything comes with a price.
Good point. We're down to 60 to 90 seconds left. How do people get your book, and then we need a wrap?
Sure. Well, it's available. Well, first of all, the title is The Elusive Force, Anna Ostrzycka and Marek Rymuszko. I won't expect you to be able to spell that, but you can find it on the website of the publisher, AnomalistBooks.com, which is in Charlottesville, Virginia. The book is available by print on demand through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other major distributors, or you can get it in e-book form on Kindle. And if you want me to leave my email address, if people have questions that you want to ask me personally, I could give that over the, would you like me to...
If you want to, and then call it a night.
Yeah, sure. It's Joel, J-O-E-L, Deco, D-E-C-O, Stern, S-T-E-R-N, @gmail.com. Joel Deco Stern @gmail.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, Joel. It was a fascinating read.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you inviting me. And feel free to reach out, anybody who's listening. I'd be delighted to answer any questions you may have.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Joel, and everyone for being here tonight. And we'll see everyone, I think, next week. And Barbara has shows coming up, I think, tomorrow and Thursday. Talk to you soon. Bye.